The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
This summer, click into cordless power with Memorial Day savings at the Home Depot. Tackle more than half an acre of grass with the convenience and gas-like power of the Ryobi 40-volt battery-powered mower. And keep your flower beds looking fresh with the 40-volt cordless string trimmer. Then clear leaves and debris with the 40-volt leaf blower. No cords, no gas, no hassle. Click into Memorial Day savings happening now at the Home Depot and on HomeDepot.com. How doers get more done.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Too Much Information is a production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to Too Much Information, the show that gives you the secret histories and little-known fascinating facts and figures behind your favorite movies, music, TV shows, and more. We are your two Bobby Boris Pickets of banality. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Redtalk.
And as you may have surmised from that intro, we are forging ahead with our special Oktoberfest here at TMI with an installment on that deathless slice of 60s novelty music cheese. It's the Velveeta of 60s novelty hits, Monster Mash, by the aforementioned Bobby Boris Pickett.
I love how much you love this song.
I would ask you your personal history with it. Do you have one?
No. Well, yeah. You know what? I do. You may not remember this. This song actually played a crucial role in our friendship and indirectly the creation of the show. I don't think you know this. Maybe I've never told you this. For those of you who don't know, which I assume is all of you, because why would you know this? I met Heigl on my first day working at People Magazine in 2016, and I spent my first day decorating my desk with posters of The Who and The Beatles and asking loudly if there was any chance I could interview Neil Young. And this was emphatically not the subject matter that people covered. We were usually doing the ins and outs of Justin Bieber's love life. And I'm pretty sure the first interview I ever did there was either Josh Groban or Harry Connick Jr. But my boss, the wise and wonderful Sarah Michaud, quickly sized up the situation and said, "Hey, there's someone I want you to meet. His name's Alex Heigl." And the unspoken subtext of this was, "He doesn't belong here either. And if you're going to have any friends while you work here, you guys should connect." And we did. And it was an immediate bond. And you intimidated me greatly because you had tattoos and I had none. And you didn't suffer fools gladly. And I do. And we got to know each other, but we never really worked together. I was an editor in the music section, and you were more of a generalist writer-reporter, if I remember correctly. So our paths didn't really cross on the day-to-day, but then one day I was assigned to edit one of your stories for the first time, and it was this compelling, amazingly, exhaustively researched history of Monster Mash by Bobby Boris Pickett. And that was the moment that we connected on this level, the TMI level. I realized that you were just as much of a freak as I was. So I actually will always think of you when I hear the song.
It was
an amazing piece. It's still out there on People right now, on People.com. So go check it out.
My parents got me one of the tapes that I had as a kid was a compilation of 60s novelty songs. So
that's
it was
adorable.
Like this and like Sheb Wooley, Purple People Eater. And I was trying to ask my dad this. He didn't remember. Do you remember what that song was that's like music concrete, like style cut up collage? It's a fake news bulletin about aliens coming to Earth, but it's like cut up from single lines of like dozens of other songs.
Oh, man. It's not Joe Meek, is it?
No. 60s alien.
I don't know.
Anyway, this was one of my, I used to play that tape over and over again. It's one of my earliest musical memories. Yeah, so from the possibly legally insane and wildly prolific producer behind this track, to the song's tenuous connection to James Brown, to Bobby Boris Pickett's dogged attempts to continually update his song with the times, here is everything you didn't know about the Monster Mash. Pickett was born in Somerville, Massachusetts in 1938. As he explained in one often aggregated interviews, he said, "You had two choices as a young man. You could either be a gangster when you grew up or an athlete. Somerville was a tough, tough place to live, but it was a place where you could leave your door open and no one would rob you." Well, maybe. Everyone knew everyone, even though it was a city 3 miles long.
And if Somerville rings a crime-related name for you, that's because its Winter Hill neighborhood, where Bobby Boris Pickett grew up, was the principal operating area of Whitey Bulger. Famous criminal head honcho, famously fictionized by Jack Nicholson in The Departed. Bulger was born 9 years before Pickett and was already a young man when the Winter Hill Gang was founded by James Buddy McLean in 1950. And the Winter Hill Gang fought a 6-year war with a group called the McLaughlin Gang in what's now known as the Boston Irish Gang War. And that started when one guy hit on a rival gang member's girlfriend at Salisbury Beach. And following said war, the Winter Hill Gang became the most powerful Irish gang on the East Coast. This is all operating in Bobby Boris Pickett's backyard.
Well, Pickett fondly recalls his childhood in Somerville.
Not a very idyllic place, if I remember.
His father managed a movie theater, though, and he spent a lot of time taking in the horror hits of Universal Studios, watching Boris Karloff, Bela Lugosi, and Lon Chaney Jr. stalk the screen in iconic films like Dracula, Frankenstein, The Mummy, and The Wolfman. At this point, the final Universal monster that anyone actually remembers came out in 1954, The Creature of the Black Lagoon. But prior to that, you know, this iconic period was kind of gone because they had spent the intervening decade introducing that entire roster of iconic monsters to Abbott and Costello. I am not exaggerating. That was like their whole 1940s. And come to think of it, though, that approach probably informed Pickett's entire life of combining spooky stuff and cheesy humor. He did mention this distribution company called Real Art, which actually cherry-picked a bunch of these old Universal monster flicks and reissued them in the 40s and 50s. And he also said that he loved the William Castle roadshow extravaganzas. Guy who did House on Haunted Hill, where he had a gimmick where a fake ghost on a wire would fly from one end of the movie theater to the other. And the buzzing seats in The Tingler.
Friend of the pod, The Tingler, making its third appearance on the TMI podcast.
Oh, I didn't realize I put it that many times. Pickett did not actually have a musical childhood. He didn't grow up singing. After a year and a half in Korea with the army as part of the Signal Corps, he was actually on his way back that he got his first experience with a singing group. He said, "On the ship we came back on, these guys were putting together a show. And there were three or four of them who were singing doo-wop and a cappella stuff, and they needed a bass baritone, so I became a member of that group."
But Boris wasn't exactly bitten by the music bug. When he got back to Massachusetts, rather than forming a band, he started performing stand-up at local places like the Irish American Club in Everett, performing an act that he freely admits he stole. He said, "The first time I went on stage in Everett was to do a 5-minute stand-up comedy spoof of Monsters, which I'd kind of ripped off from a guy I'd seen do it on a boat when I was returning from Korea in 1958. He did a spoof of Monsters. I just watched him and thought, that's a great act. He was doing Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi impressions. I said, you wrote that act? He said, no, I stole it from Jack Carter. I saw it on TV. I said, oh, okay. Then you won't mind if I use it. And he said, no. And Pickett took that act and started winning weekly talent contests with it. And I guess he'd get $25 a pop each time he won, which, as he said, was a lot of money in those days for an unemployed ex-GI.
But Pickett could not be kept in Somerville. No, his ambitions were larger. He spent a year in Massachusetts before moving out to Hollywood to try and make it as an actor, during which time he apparently dated Cloris Leachman.
That's crazy. Wow.
And Diane Cannon, the eventual wife of Cary Grant. And this is so funny. This is that truth is stranger than fiction stuff, man. He happened to run into some other dudes from Somerville while he was bumming around Hollywood with the astoundingly perfect names of Lenny and Billy Capizzi. They grew up in Winter Hill as well. And, he said that they'd shown up in Hollywood at this time with two other Italian boys, Ronnie Del Toro and Lou Toscano. Just, whew.
Batting a thousand.
The smell of olive oil suddenly came into my nostrils.
You can
folks. I can say that. And they were going to start a singing group called The Cordials, and they asked me if I wanted to join them. He continued, we'd sing at a place called Alvo Turno's on Pico Boulevard on Friday nights. We sang in the parking lot of Ben Frank's, wherever we could get a paying gig. Interestingly enough, Alvo Turno's was owned by Timmy Euro, who is a singer who counted Elvis among her fans. He bought a private table for her Vegas shows, and Morrissey, who announced her death on his website in 2004. Do you know these songs? It'll Never Be Over For Me and What's the Matter, Baby? What's the Matter, Baby was covered by the Small Faces as the B-side of their debut single in 1965.
What?
There you have it, folks. We got to one degree of separation between Morrissey and the Faces and Monster Mash. That is the TMI guarantee.
Wow.
Jordan, tell us about Ben Frank's.
Yeah, Ben Frank's, the place where I used to play in the parking lot. That was a well-known hippie hangout in L.A. in the 60s. The advertisement that was soliciting actors to audition for the Monkees in 1965 specified Ben Frank types, which basically is a euphemism for long hairs. Now it's a Mel's Diner on Sunset, and they kept all the original architecture and everything. It's really cool. One of the songs that was in the Cordial set, Bobby's early band, was Little Darlin', recorded by the Diamonds, a doo-wop classic. I love that song. And I guess Pickett asked Lenny if he could do a Boris Karloff impression in the middle of the song, which apparently audiences immediately loved. I don't know how they would shoehorn that in there, but Pickett's account.
There's a monologue. There's like a monologue part in the beginning, or okay, in like the middle of the song, and it's sung by the bass baritone. Pickett was like, hey, how about I do this Boris Karloff impression?
God, as much as I love most 50s schmaltz, the whole phenomenon of like the mid-song breakdown where, you know, the Elvis doing this, Are You Lonesome Tonight? Yeah.
I wanted to tell you something. Yeah.
I hate that.
I just needed to let you know. Yeah, and let's find the little lyrics. Let's see if we can do a little TMI reenactment of what this must have been like. What is the monologue? Oh my God. Do you know the guy who wrote this song?
No.
Dave Somerville.
No way.
Yeah. Okay, so the monologue in the middle. Hang on. I was working in the lab. My darling, I need you to call my own and never do wrong. To hold in mind your little hand.
Something like that. It sounded something like that. And lightning struck.
Inexplicably, people loved it. And Bobby's accounts for the rest of this timeline has varied over the years. In one telling, the very night he did this bit on stage for the first time, his bandmate Lenny said to him, you know, we should record a novelty song like this. Something like the Flying Purple People Eater, which had become a big hit around this time. You're doing the...
I'm just...
Chuck, it's Marvin.
Your cousin, Bobby Boris Pickett.
You know that new sound you're looking for?
I was working in the lab.
In another version of this story, Bobby says that the group was performing on a beach, and after he did the Boris Karloff bit, and a girl came up to them and said, my old man produces records. He did the song Alley Oop. He would love you guys. He'll get you a record contract. And that old man was Gary Paxton, who'd had hits as part of Skippin' Flip, who I don't know, and the Hollywood Argyles, who did the song Alley Oop, which was a number one hit. And that song was actually referenced by David Bowie on the song Life on Mars. The lyric, look at that caveman go, is a line from Alley Oop.
There's also Mark Bolan also referenced it in a song called Truck on Tyke.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, Gary S. Paxton. Oh, my God. This guy's life is insane. I'm just going to do the quick bullet point rundown. Paxton grew up with an adopted family on a Kansas farm with no electricity or running water. He started playing in bands at 12 years old. I heard at one point he backed Buck Owens. Owens or Merle Haggard, some guy in Bakersfield, because he was part of the Bakersfield sound as well. And he basically never stopped working in music. By the 60s, he operated a bunch of different labels that basically just existed to put out music that he made. I read one account that he owned and operated, or at least operated, five studios.
He was involved with actual villain of the LA music industry, Kim Fowley.
Yes. Kim Fowley worked with the Runaways. And
well, he put them together, right?
Yeah, but Jackie Foxx, the bassist, accused him of rape years later. Yeah.
Nobody has anything nice to say about Kim Fowley.
No.
But Paxton was a genuine eccentric. I've heard many people refer to him as just being dirty and long-haired, even by 60s standards. Also, this is in the early 60s. This is in pre, like, the hippie stereotype. He alienated musicians with his in-studio demeanor and refused to play ball with other labeled executives when it came to getting his stuff played. People just put up with him because he crafted hits. Phil Spector was reportedly literally actually frightened by him.
I say good.
Once, after a radio station turned down one of his songs, Paxton assembled a protest parade down Hollywood Boulevard that starred 15 cheerleaders and a live elephant pulling a Volkswagen convertible. This got him arrested when the elephant pooped in the street. The song was called Elephant Game, parentheses, part one, by Renfro and Jackson, for context, lest you think he just got an unsolicited elephant. Paxton moved to Nashville in the 1970s and converted to Christianity after wandering into a church while stoned because he was in the middle of an existential crisis after his musical partner died. This failed to put a dent in his eccentricities. For 1972's Clone Affair, he shaved his head and eyebrows and started wearing a cape. When his 1975 solo album, The Astonishing, Outrageous, Amazing, Incredible, Unbelievable, Different World of Gary S. Paxton, won a Grammy, he showed up to the ceremony wearing a sleeveless black vest and leather pants. At this time, it's important to note he had a large Mennonite beard and was going around in a pseudo-stovepipe hat.
What the hell did he win a Grammy for?
Like, Best Inspirational Album.
Oh, okay. Sure.
In 1980, he was shot 5 times by men hired by a country star he was producing who was supposedly attempting to get out of his contract or was simply mad about the terms of his contract. I don't remember which one it was. This sidelined him for 8 years, and he carried 2 bullets from the shooting in his body for the rest of his life. Nonetheless, he traveled to jail to forgive the men personally. In 1987, the Washington Post reported that Tammy Faye Baker had developed a crush on Paxton around the same time that her husband, Jim Baker, has had the big scandal with Jessica Hahn, the secretary at the evangelical church the Bakers ran. Sadly, this basically ended Paxton's career in the gospel Christian music world because he was at the center of this big infidelity scandal. In 1999, he moved to Branson, Missouri, friend of the pod, Branson, Missouri. And began performing in a mask and cape as Grandpa Rock. He died in 2016. He once estimated he had written 2,000 songs. A sampling of my favorite titles include Jesus is My Lawyer in Heaven, If You're Happy, Notify Your Face, and When I Die, Just Bury Me at Walmart So My Wife Will Come Visit Me. Gary S. Paxton, everyone.
I just want to pause and savor all those for a moment. Wow. Everything that, no matter what I could say after that, really feels like a tremendous letdown. But Bobby Pickett, around this time, actually quit the Cordials for a brief time, his band, to pursue work as an actor. Explaining at one point, I got an agent after many, many months. And after 2 weeks of being with him, he died of a heart attack. So, I guess seeing that as some sort of a sign, he returns to work with the Cordials to revisit the whole novelty song thing.
Let's give you some context for the Monster Craze. Well, let's just give you some context for the Monster Mash, period. By 1962, the Monster Craze of the 1950s, which was aided by those reissues and television, because all this stuff started getting syndicated on TV, that had really blossomed. In 1953, a stymied actress named Malia Nurmi created the character of Vampira, which is she created as a ripoff of Morticia Adams, and she launched a successful show that started the template of these horror host shows. Basically, in costume, she would introduce these classic horror films and mock them. It was like a slash comedy show, and it was all this stuff that affiliates could get the rights to rebroadcast either free or cheap. And so they would just do these buttons with her making fun of them and broadcast these. And it was huge. I mean, even though it only ran for a year, soon any regional television station that had the budget would have one of these of their own. The one in Philadelphia was hosted by a guy named John Zacherly, who is a buddy with Dick Clark. Zacherly actually cut a novelty single called Dinner with Drac that climbed to number 6 as high as on Billboard in 1958, which is the same year that this very influential fan magazine called Famous Monsters of Filmland debuts. Adjacent to all of this is the atomic age monster movies of the 50s. You have 1951's The Day the Earth Stood Still, The War of the Worlds, 1953, 1956's Invasion of the Body Snatchers. And then right around the turn of the decade, horror becomes much more popular. We have these proto-slashers like Peeping Tom and Psycho, both in 1960. Mario Bava directs Black Sunday, which is banned. It's a movie, it's a witchcraft-themed movie. It was banned for being, I believe, explicit or the occult themes. And then Roger Corman puts out a series of these Edgar Allan Poe adaptations, Mask of the Black Death, Pit in the Pendulum, and those are all starring Vincent Price. It's amazing to think about this stuff in context because until the exploitation era, horror was like not disreputable. This was like cheesy popcorn entertainment. They were like the Marvel movies of their day.
I didn't know that. That's really interesting. What changed?
Well, basically, I mean, this is kind of an armchair theory of mine, but I feel comfortable putting it out there. You started to get that wave of new Hollywood guys come out of USC around this time. John Carpenter particularly, and Wes Craven is the other big one. And so in the 70s, well, they had forebears. There's a guy named Herschel Gordon Lewis who was creating these violent exploitation movies as early as the 60s. He had Blood Feast. His nickname is the Godfather of Gore. But then through the mid-70s, the grindhouse circuit really kicks in, and that's when you do see these movies start to get way more explicit. And then at the tail end of the 70s, you have basically the kind of shots across the bow are Last House on the Left, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and Halloween. And Halloween was the explicit inspiration for Sean Cunningham, who was directing porn, to make Friday the 13th. And that is really what jumpstarts the slasher craze of the 80s. And then concurrently with that, you have what's called the Video Nasties in the UK, which was a bunch of banned titles. So basically late 70s through the mid 80s is when it gets really gross. I mean, also the practical effects advance to the point where people like Tom Savini are coming out of Vietnam and just going into Hollywood and making gore effects that reminded him of Vietnam. That is explicitly his inspiration for the stuff on the George Romero. He was like, yeah, I was just doing all the stuff I saw in Nam.
Wow.
Anyway, don't ever prompt me about horror movies again because you'll get a 3-minute monologue.
We're going to take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more Too Much Information in just a moment.
Today, I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a Gaginianaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Whether you're a savvy spender maximizing your savings with cashback rewards, a thrifty rate watcher seeking the lowest interest, or a travel enthusiast looking for extraordinary perks, Kemba Financial Credit Union has a Visa to complement your lifestyle and unique needs. Apply today at Kemba.org to unlock a limited-time 2% cashback on purchases and pay 0% interest on balance transfers for an entire year with a new Visa from Kemba. You deserve a card that works for you. Restrictions apply. Offer ends June 30th, 2024.
Well, all of this to say, back to the Monster Mash. By 1962, the national pump was primed for a guy to do an extended Boris Karloff riff in a novelty song. And Pickett remembers the May, or sometimes June, accounts vary, 1962 writing session that produced Monster Mash thusly. Lenny Capizzi said, "Yeah, come on over Saturday. I go over at the designated time, and of course he's asleep. I have to wake him up." And he continued the account in his 2005 autobiography. "Lenny sat down at the piano and began futzing with various four-chord progressions, and I stood next to the piano. Like me, Lenny was a major horror movie fan from childhood. He loved Bela Lugosi as Dracula. He knew I had a Boris Karloff voice pretty nailed, although in retrospect, I feel that what I actually had was a very cartoonish rendition of that wonderful actor's voice." You say that Pickett's 2005 autobiography, which is called Monster Mash, Half Dead in Hollywood, is extremely rare, and copies of it are selling for upwards of $300 on Amazon.
Yeah, dude. Not wow. Available digitally either. I would have read the whole thing. Lenny arrives at the classic doo-wop 1 minor 6 4 5 chord progression, and Pickett said it was his idea to capitalize on the monster craze and the novelty dance craze. He said, "At the time, I thought the twist was the latest dance, but Lenny said, no, it's the mashed potato. So I said, that's even better. We can call it the Monster Mash Potato. We shortened it to Monster Mash, and the rest was history." In about 3 hours, they cut a piano and voice demo on a mono woolen sack tape recorder and brought it to Paxton, who said, "Boys, you got a hit on your hands."
So Brian Wilson used to use to work out his harmonies in the early Beach Boys songs, an old woolen sack tape recorder.
Not the first time the Beach Boys are going to come up here.
Oh, yeah.
Incidentally, Lenny was correct. Here's a history about the mash. Not that you folks asked for it. D.D. Sharp's Mashed Potato Time had reached number one on the Cashbox Top 100 and Billboard R&B charts in 1962, as well as the number two spot on the Billboard Hot 100. There's a great article about Monster Mash on Billboard that goes into the history of the mashed potato. Billboard claims that this dance actually originated with James Brown, baby, the hardest working man in show business. In the late 50s, in his live shows, he released a top 10 R&B instrumental called Do the Mashed Potatoes in 1960.
I have that on 45. Yeah, I guess for contractual reasons, the recording was credited to Nat Kendrick and the Swans. And it's just a wild song. I don't think it's him. I think it's like a local DJ he got to do the vocals for it, just screaming different types of potatoes over a 1-4-5 pattern. It's like hash
amazing.
Browns, mashed potatoes. Yeah, it's pretty weird.
You would have thought an Irish guy would have cut that song.
Too soon.
Sorry. Our first Irish potato famine joke. But in a post-twist world, in 1962, the label Cameo Parkway, they wanted a song that would capitalize on the twist on the order of Please Mr. Postman, Marvelette's 1961 hit. And in fact, Mashed Potato Time, that D.D. Sharp song, is so similar to Please Mr. Postman that they had to share writing credit on it. And the lyrics to Mashed Potato Time include references to not just Please Mr. Postman, but the Tokens' number one hit, The Lion Sleeps Tonight, and Gary Bond's Dear Lady Twist. So you have a reissue of an older song that has been rewritten to sound like new songs. Right?
And incorporating lyrical references from other new songs. Yes.
Yeah.
And this started a phenomenon of what you've very appropriately called recursive novelty dance numbers, in which pop songs begin referencing dance crazes that were themselves lifting from earlier dance crazes. James Brown responded to Mashed Potato Time with his song Mashed Potatoes USA, while Chris Montez's Let's Dance, The Contours' Do You Love Me, Chris Kenner's Land of a Thousand Dances, and Connie Francis's V-A-C-A-T-I-O-N, and also Sam Cooke's Having a Party, all name drop the mashed potato dance. And Sam Cooke was probably the best at surfing this trend. He calls out the mashed potatoes, also the soul twist in his song Having a Party, which followed his own twist hit, Twistin' the Night Away. And Cooke even worked a line about a cat named Frankenstein in his 1963 hit Another Saturday Night. You know, Another Saturday Night Ain't Got Nobody, which is absolutely a reference to the Monster Mash.
That means somewhere in the world there is a, there's probably an outtake somewhere of Sam Cooke singing Monster Mash.
Which that
I will pay good money for. Anyway, Gary S. Paxton, Lenny Capizzi, and Bobby Pickett waste little time in getting into the studio to record Monster Mash. This is so interesting to me, this whole twisted origin of the song. I really went a little cross-eyed with it. Pickett has frequently repeated this notion that the Monster Mash session took place on the same day that Herb Alpert was in the studio recording The Lonely Bull, which is the first single released on A&M Records, and Jimmy Rogers was there recording his hit Honeycomb. So it has been said that Lonely Bull sessions took place at Conway Recorders in Hollywood. Gets deeper, though. Jordan.
That is right. Meanwhile, singer Darlene Love, who is a legend in early 60s pop music, sang on He's a Rebel and Christmas Baby, Please Come Home, like, next to Ronnie Spector, probably the singer most famously identified with Phil Spector and the Wall of Sound type stuff. She was part of a singing group called The Blossoms, who were sort of the first call backing singer group for all sorts of... if you're familiar with the Wrecking Crew, the group of musicians who were the first call session players on all LA pop sessions at this time, they were sort of the singing equivalent. They sang on all sorts of stuff. Anyway, she claims that Monster Mash was recorded at Gold Star Studios, which is where Phil Spector cut most of his records. Again, not where Bobby Pickett remembers cutting the song. Darlene says that, incredibly, super producer Lou Adler, who worked with the Mamas and the Papas and later produced Carole King's Tapestry album, told her about Monster Mash for the first time. And in an interview with Billboard, she says she remembers thinking, oh, please, a Halloween song? Who's going to do a song about Halloween? She said, quote, we sat down and listened to the song to try to figure out what the background was going to be. And after the initial backing tracks were laid down, the vocalist came and sang live with Bobby Pickett. She said he had to sing his vocals so we could figure out where to come in. It made it more fun with him singing his line and then us answering him.
It's just like the Sun Records scene from Walk the Line. But there's Sam Phillips is like, you have 15 minutes to sing me something that will strike me down to my very core. I was working in the lab. I told you I polished that one.
That was good. That's really good.
If you or a loved one help record Monster Mash, please tell us where the hell it was cut, because it's driving me nuts. Personnel-wise, the band credited as the Crypt Kickers on Monster Mash was the aforementioned Gary S. Paxton, a writing partner of his named Johnny Dog McRae, who I guess had wrote songs for Ray Charles, George Jones, Reba McEntire, possibly the Blossoms, backup singers of the Blossoms, and another session singer named Ricky Page. Leon Russell is often credited with playing piano on Monster Mash. That is not true. Pickett said he played on the B-side, Monster Mash Party, because he said he got to the session late. And this is what gives credence to the Herb Alpert thing, because Russell was a member of the Wrecking Crew, and they are credited with playing on that Herb Alpert track. So, I don't know. Do with that what you will. Apparently, Ricky Page is singing the line, ooh, tennis shoe, wah-ooh, wah-ooh, in the song's bridge. And Pickett told Dr. Sure. Demento in 2006, we don't know why. Isn't that Girl by the Beatles? John Lennon sneaked in tit.
Yes.
Instead of tit, tit, he's singing tit, 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 because he was a child.
Yeah. Meanwhile, adding to the insane early 60s pop superstardom brew that went into making this song, drummer for The Ventures, you know, Walk Don't Run fame, incredible 60s surf guitar instrumental group, The Ventures, Mel Taylor is credited with playing on Monster Mash. And Taylor had moved from LA from his native Tennessee and was working as a meat cutter at the Grand Central Market in 1962. When he wasn't busy being a venture. And through his gigs at night, he picked up session work during the day, including supposedly Monster Mash and The Lonely Bull by Herb Alpert and the Tijuana Brass, for which he was paid $10 to record on the very same day. Think about that. Ventures drummer Mel Taylor possibly recorded the very first single on A&M Records and also Monster Mash in a single afternoon. Incredible. For his day rate.
Yeah, for a flat fee. He may have been called on the session because of Paxton as well. I've heard some sources that credit him with playing the drums on Alley Oop. But Gary Paxton said that was not correct. So I don't know, man. I mean, the whole thing about, I have to stop myself from going too far into this because these guys were making like 17 songs a day, 5 days a week.
Right.
Calling in whoever, you know. Pickett's own account of the session, though, which cost a whopping $300, is that it took between 2 and 3 hours and his vocals were done in 30 minutes. Gary Paxton did all the sound effects, he said, like a straw into a glass of water to get the bubbling lab sound. He was pulling
a submarine, too.
Mm-hmm. He was pulling a rusty nail out of a board to get the sound of the coffin creaking.
Oh, wow.
Those are actual chains. He dragged chains across the floor to get the sound of chains. Once they were finished, mixes took a day, perhaps unsurprisingly.
I'm shocked it took that long.
Yeah. Paxton took the finished 45 around to 4 major labels and they all turned it down. So he pressed up, I've heard between 500 and 1,000 records on his own label, Garpax, or I guess Garpax, and drove north from LA, stopping in Ventura, Bakersfield, and Fresno to hand distribute copies of Monster Mash to DJs. Pickett said, by the time Gary got back to Southern California, his phone had been lighting up like a Christmas tree. London Records, which was, of course, one of the outfits that had turned him down, called and said they had changed their mind, of course. The records were being ordered on a massive level.
Monster Mash debuted on the Billboard Hot 100 the week of September 8th, 1962. And 6 weeks later, the single knocked the Four Seasons' Sherry from the top spot to begin a 2-week reign at number one that ended 4 days before Halloween. And it's returned to the chart multiple times over the years, including in 1970 and also 1973. This is hilarious to me. The BBC famously banned Monster Mash upon its initial release for being, quote, too morbid. And it only lifted the ban in 1973 when it hit number 3 in the UK. Did they even do Halloween over there? Like,
oh, yeah, maybe not. I don't think it is as much of a thing overseas. Yeah.
The song obviously recharts digitally pretty much every October. In 2018, Billboard reported that it appeared in 2005 and also between 2007 and 2011 and again between 2013 and 2017. Wonder what happened to the years when it didn't. Just people weren't feeling the Halloween spirit.
Thriller took over. Pickett appeared on American Bandstand to perform the song. And again in 1973 when the song recharted. And Paxton duly sent him out on the road for sock hops and these other one-off shows. He said he would start in northern Maine and then do Jersey, Boston, New York. This is hilarious. I always use the house band, wherever it was, much like Chuck Berry. Yes, Bobby, that is how you were like Chuck Berry. I'd hit town, teach the band the chord changes my entire act, and we'd go on stage and do it. My favorite tour story of his is that his bus supposedly once broke down outside of Frankenstein, Missouri.
No way. No way. That's too... He's making that up.
He might be.
Oh, my God. The song notched fans and enemies, as we'll get to in a minute, in high places. From an early live performance, Bobby Boris Pickett was backed by a then-unknown Beach Boys. And there's a truly surreal clip of the band performing the Monster Mash with... I'll just say animated. You said unhinged. Mike Love on vocals, and a visibly miserable Brian Wilson introduces it as Mike's favorite song.
It's
anybody
so
who knows
sad.
Anything about the history between Mike Love and Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys will know how loaded that exchange probably was. Boris Karloff himself was apparently a fan of the Monster Mash. Pickett later said, one of the London Records promotion men, a guy by the name of George Sherlock, ran into Boris Karloff at Wallach's Music City, which is a big record store in LA, as he was buying a copy of the Monster Mash album. And in fact, you can actually see Boris Karloff alongside Ted Cassidy, who played Lurch on The Addams Family, performing Monster Mash on the TV show Shindig in 1965, a music show. In other words, Boris Karloff is doing an impression of the guy who's doing an impression of him. Sadly, apparently Bobby Boris Pickett and Boris Karloff never actually met. That's a shame.
But lest you thought that was as weird as it gets, you can see a version of this song performed by Mike Tyson and Bobby Brown on Kimmel in 2005. So if that's a thing that you want, go nuts. There is an oft-repeated line that Elvis Presley hated Monster Mash. And I was able to trace this anecdote to a book that came out in 1993 called The Wacky Top 40 by guys named Bruce Nash and Alan Zullo. These are Pickett's words. I was a real Elvis fan. One day after the song had become a hit, I bumped into this girl who used to hang around Elvis's house in Los Angeles. So I asked her, "How's the king?" She said, "Well, he hates your record, Bobby." When I asked why, she told me, "He thinks it's the stupidest thing he's ever heard." So I said, "Well, whoever liked him anyway." I don't think he knew who Boris Karloff was, to tell you the truth. Pickett would often retell this story when performing the song live, ending it with, "If you're still out there listening, Elvis, I'm still here," which is such a great shot across the bow. Apparently, Tiny Tim, these two did a lot of tours together. Pickett just mentioned talking about touring with Tiny Tim. He said, "Tiny Tim thinks Elvis is still alive."
So, I mean, it's arguably Bobby Boris Pickett and Tiny Tim are the two biggest novelty artists, I would argue, possibly of all time, certainly of the 20th century. Kings of the novelty circuit. Tiny Tim, man, eccentric dude. He apparently used to drink bottles of salsa. And what's going through your head right now?
Him like berating a manager, like his manager, but it's in the it's in his falsetto. Yeah. Like, "Sharon, it's time for my 3 p.m. salsa."
Yeah,
the tulips.
He must have had an undiagnosed OCD. He used to use not only paper towels, but a very specific brand of paper towels, Viva paper towels, whenever he went to hotels, because he didn't trust that the towels were clean. So he would always dry himself off with paper towels after showers. He wore adult diapers when he was out because he didn't like using other people's bathrooms.
Jesus Christ.
And he applied oil of Olay 8 times a day. Yeah. Elvis was very, when he hated something, he let you know. There's the famous story about he apparently hated Robert Goulet. I don't know how much he actually hated him, or it became a bit. And whenever he'd be watching TV and Robert Goulet came on, he would just take out his gun and shoot the TV.
Jesus Christ.
And so the Graceland archives have all these TVs with gunshots in them from when Elvis shot the TV out when Robert Goulet was on.
That is incredible.
Yeah. "He's got no heart." That's what Elvis used to say whenever he was on.
That is wild. A PB&J and bacon sandwich in one hand and a pistol in the other, just getting furious at Robert Goulet.
As you meditate on that, we'll be right back with more Too Much Information after these messages.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Snagajob is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Anyway, Pickett was not able to successfully capitalize on that hit. In another example of music industry throat cutting, John Zacherle, who you'll remember was one of the original TV horror hosts and predated Pickett with his own novelty hit Dinner with Drac, actually beat him to the punch to record a Monster Mash album, a full-length Monster Mash. He released his own LP with a cover of Bobby Morris Pickett's song on Cameo Parkway before Pickett could get Capizzi and Paxton into the studio for a follow-up, which is why Pickett's full-length is called the original Monster Mash. But there's apparently no bad blood. You can see footage of the pair performing the song together on YouTube. Pickett said Gary, like Lenny, was not a terribly professional individual, which is a tremendous understatement. So there would always be delays in areas of promotion and recording dates. By the time we had finished Monster's Holiday and Monster Motion, which was the follow-up single, John Zacherle on Cameo Parkway Records had sold 40,000 copies of a unit called Monster Mash. That's Taylor Swift numbers these days.
yeah, seriously.
I blamed Gary and I blamed London Records for not getting an LP out to follow the two singles. Getting Gary and me into the studio was a laborious process. Once we got there, it was done in a rush and it was slipshod. It was amazing that anything got done at all.
Monster Motion. That's got to be a Locomotion play.
Yep. You
That's
nailed
good.
It.
I like that.
He did move on, at least artistically, relatively quickly, at least in the moment. He attempted to pivot to teen idol style crooning with a gloppy ballad called Graduation Day, which he has repeatedly called embarrassing, although it did crack the Hot 100 in June 63, which keeps him from being a true one-hit wonder in the strictest definition of the word.
Oh, that's a good song, though. The Beach Boys did a version of that that was released as a bonus track a couple of years ago.
I love the fact that Mike Love was out there just agitating for Bobby Boris Pickett in the Beach Boys. He's like, we got to do another cover. When Star Trek came out in the Dr. Demento show 12 years later, Mike Love somewhere was like, it's a good song.
Brian, get out of bed. Brian, I got a song for you.
I'll give you a cheeseburger if you do this Star Trek parody.
They would bribe him the right songs with bags of cheeseburgers.
Who among us? I mean, that's how you get me to do this f-ing podcast. A year later, Bobby rehashed the Karloff impression for a cover of an old novelty Western swing song called Smoke, Smoke, Smoke That Cigarette. You may remember the original being in the opening credits of the Aaron Eckhart film, Thank You for Smoking. The band on that he christened the Filter Tip Kickers. Sadly, that had the poor timing to be released just as the dangers of smoking were beginning to be made public. So, whoops.
He was, however, able to parlay his success into a run of guest spots on TV shows like Dr. Kildare, Petticoat Junction, The Beverly Hillbillies, Bonanza. Bobby Boris Pickett was on Bonanza?
You know it.
Wow. And later, T.J. Hooker, starring William Shatner. And he was also in commercials for things like Schlitz Beer and Lipton Iced Tea. Just as an, I just can't imagine him appearing in any of these things without referencing the fact that he was the voice of Monster Mash.
I just love Bobby's work ethic, man. You cannot accuse this guy of not getting out there and pounding the damn pavement. Just covered
true.
In flop sweat, staggering from one commercial to bit part. God love him.
But unfortunately, real success as an actor eluded him, though he continued to appear in regional theater wherever he lived throughout the rest of his life, including in an off-Broadway performance in New York, and he would later co-star with Tony Curtis in a movie that Orson Welles was supposed to have been involved with, 1989's Lobster Man from Mars.
I have heard that Orson Welles was supposed to, heard, I've read this. I gotta stop saying that. Sources tell me, me Googling things alone at 3 a.m. in my pajama pants, told me that Orson Welles was supposed to star in this movie and died, and Tony Curtis picked it up.
Oh my God.
Anyway, from the late 60s into the early 70s, Pickett apparently pivoted to working in a folk duo with his then wife, Joan Payne, working what he called the ski resort areas, singing soft folk harmonies. There are photos, or at least a photo, of the two of them together doing this act as Pickett and Payne on sale on eBay. He has a mustache and long hair and looks like Lee Hazelwood. It's amazing. They supposedly toured Europe. I read somewhere that they got as far as Afghanistan. Then they both moved to New York in 1972, where Pickett was driving a cab and she was working as a waitress before Monster Mash recharted again in 73. He said in 1995, either to the Washington Post or the LA Times, I forget, but he said, it was on the charts for 6 months before anyone told me that it had been re-released, let alone charted. I called the head of London Records, Walt McGuire, and said, Walt, I hear the record's doing well. He said, yeah. I said, well, I'm driving a cab here in New York City. I was wondering if I could turn my cab in and come get a check.
Aww.
I have, oh, yeah, a little bit. Hey, Philip Glass drove a cab until Einstein on the Beach. He was driving a cab when Einstein on the Beach came out.
Oh, yeah.
I have read this and been unable to substantiate, but I dearly hope it is true that when Pickett took the Crypt Kickers out again in 73, a teenaged Eddie Van Halen was among the musicians who backed him up. The timeline tracks, Eddie would have been like 18 or 19 Whoa. When they came through California. So might have been in one of the pickup bands. He did pop sort of back into the mainstream in the 1970s, with a truly, truly shitty Star Trek novelty hit called Star Drek.
I've never heard this.
It's just like spoken word. It's awful. It's not even to like a recognizable tune. It appeared on Dr. Demento and apparently became its most requested number. Dr. Demento was a huge, I guess, and dear friend, big fan and friend of Bobby Boris Pickett. He would just play whatever Bobby put out. But in that song, the USS Enterprise is renamed the Booby Prize.
I don't get it.
I think Booby Prize was like a gag prize back in the day. Well, okay. I don't think it was like a boob. Oh. I don't think it was like a cleavage reference.
Okay.
But who's to say?
Who's to say? the year after that, Bobby came out with King.
You can't even say it with a straight face.
I can't. Because I as you referenced, I thought it was going to be an Elton John reference.
So did I. I'm so mad it wasn't.
He came out with King Kong, Your Song, which is sadly not a parody of Elton John's Your Song. It was right there. You could have. And in 1985, Bobby released Monster Rap, which is what you'd expect. Frankenstein's monster is having trouble learning how to speak. So the scientist, who takes the form of Bobby Boris Pickett's Boris Karloff impression, teaches him how to rap. And amazingly,
Have you heard that? Did you listen to that one?
No, I didn't.
Oh, it's so good. It's actually like, it's pretty funny because it's like, there are in fact, like, there's like drum programming and synths on it. So it like sort of sounds like hip hop of the time.
And amazingly, Bobby Boris Pickett kept this going into 2005 when he teamed with an environmental organization, Clean Air, and released Climate Mash, which that's a stretch. It's Monster Mash, as you can imagine, with lyrics about climate change. A worthy cause, yes, but...
And one near and dear to his heart.
Yes, that's true. Just the year prior, in 2004, he'd released Monster Slash, sponsored by the Campaign to Protect America's Lands and Defenders of Wildlife Action Fund, which encouraged citizens to write in against a proposal to permit logging, mining, and other activities in protected areas.
God love him. One of his most common quips about the song was, it's paid my rent for the last insert however many decades been. He said that in every interview. But the rights to the song were messed up, you know, as you would expect for an early 60s novelty song cut by the likes of Gary S. Paxton. So he's recut Monster Mash a few times. When Paxton was still alive, Pickett told the LA Times, this is in 87, that the two had planned to re-release Monster Mash in 1977. London Records had distributed the initial single. That label was later bought by PolyGram. So Pickett explained, the lawyers told us that PolyGram International held the rights. So we went to them, but they told us, we don't own that song. So we went ahead and released it on Rhino Records. And PolyGram's lawyers call us and say, you can't do that. We own that record. It's been kind of that thing all along. A single that sells 4 million copies still gets lost in the paperwork. 2 years later, 1989, a guy by the name of Stuart Hirsch, who is the son of Marshall King, the resident hypnotist on the Howard Stern show, began managing Pickett and learned that he did not own the master recording of the original song. So in 1993, they recut a note-perfect recreation of the song, which they began marketing for licensing opportunities via a direct website, www.themonstermash.com, which is still live to this day, and it features the promise, "We monstrously undercut Universal and Rhino," which were the other two people you would have to go through to license it. As I mentioned, it is still up, and it contains Hirsch's personal phone number and his email address, which is simply the1960s@aol.com.
Incredible.
As of 1995, Pickett was telling journalist Jan Allen Henderson that, "I've worked more in the last 5 years than I have in 15 or 20, including a theme park called Spooky World." I guess there were two of them. This was like an international thing, and now
I've never heard of Spooky World.
I don't know.
I was one in New Hampshire.
Yeah. Around this time, another thing rose from the dead in Bobby Pickett's life. He had written a musical called "I'm Sorry the Bridge Is Out, You'll Have to Spend the Night" with a guy named Sheldon Allman, who's a television writer who also wrote the lyrics to the George of the Jungle theme song. And they teamed up on this. And I guess it was picked up by some local theaters. At some point, it came to the attention of the guys who co-wrote Toy Story, Joel Cohen, not the one you're thinking of, and Alex Sokolow. They produced a movie called Monster Mash, the movie of this, which stars not only Bobby Pickett and Dr. Demento, but John Waters' bit player Mink Stole, Full House's Candace Cameron, and the host of The View and Dancing with the Stars judge Carrie Ann Inaba. Not the Joel Cohen you're thinking of, but you wouldn't be the first person to make that mistake. Bill Murray famously only signed on to do the Garfield movie because he saw Joel Cohen's name on the script and thought it was the good one. As I mentioned earlier, Bobby Boris Pickett's autobiography is currently going for hundreds of dollars on eBay, so I was not able to get a lot of details about his personal life, but from what I was, it seemed kind of sad. He and Joan divorced, and at some point in the 1970s, their son drowned in a swimming pool when he was 3 years old. You know, you want to put, like, review lens on this, but it does seem like this guy's life had a lot of death in it. There was his agent who died 2 weeks after signing him, his son tragically drowned, and Lenny Capizzi, who wrote the song with him, died in 1989 after battling heroin addiction.
But there was an even bigger twist waiting in the wings for Pickett. His manager, Stuart Hirsch, told Vice in 2014 that at one point, Pickett made an offhand comment to him that he might have a daughter somewhere out in the world. And the pair undertook a search and found the likely candidate in 1997, but a DNA test proved negative. Soon after, a completely different woman contacted them, claiming to be Pickett's daughter. Incredibly, this happened a week before Halloween that year, of course. And Pickett's sister, Linda S. Proctor, said she remembered the day of the call. She told a newspaper that when Pickett hung up the phone that day, he said he knew she was someone special the minute he heard her voice. And his manager, Stuart Hirsch, added, "They met up at the airport, and they looked so similar that they didn't even have to do a DNA test." And Pickett, he said, went from this loner to a family guy, and he loved it. And he spent the holidays with his newfound daughter and grandkids, and it was beautiful. And the woman, whose name was Nancy Huss, H-U-U-S, she'd obviously heard the song Monster Mash before. She told Billboard, "When I found him, he was out of his mind thrilled since he thought he was going to grow old alone. I still remember the night I told my kids that Grandpa is the Monster Mash singer. Not every child gets to hear their dad on the radio every year. I feel blessed."
That story, man, just comes out of nowhere and just gets me. I love that arc for him. Bobby Pickett died in April of 2007 of leukemia. He kept performing live until November 2006.
Well, that's unbelievable.
Hirsch has this tremendous anecdote. He said that he told Vice that he would call Pickett at the hospital to check up on him after his regular blood transfusions. And Pickett would get on the phone and say in his Dracula voice, "Stu, there's nothing like fresh blood."
Oh, incredible. This guy commits to the bit.
Love it. Nancy was at Pickett's side when he died, and true to form, Bobby Boris Pickett was able to get his name in the headlines one last time after he shuffled loose this mortal coil. She said in 2007, "I saw a show about turning cremated remains into diamonds, and I immediately called my father and told him that I wanted to make a diamond from his cremated remains. He loved the idea. This company called Life Gem complied, creating a 0.44 carat colorless diamond from Bobby's remains, and she wears in a white gold solitaire ring to this day." They sent out a press release with this news and that quote, and everyone and their mother gleefully aggregated it because you can't keep Bobby Boris Pickett down. I love this story. I love this song. There is something so wonderfully American about the story of Bobby Pickett. He was a guy, here's a guy who wanted to be one thing, lucked into being another thing that he didn't love that much, which he stole in the first place, and then maintained an iron grip on that consolation prize for his entire life, choking every last bit of life out of it until the end of his own. And now every year, he rises from the grave with a gleeful laugh to help us celebrate Halloween, the most wonderfully American of all holidays. The day we stop shutting death away in its sterile cloisters, march it out into our streets and windows to stare it full in the eye, and threaten it, telling it to give us candy or we'll TP its house. God, I love Halloween. "I'm glad I did the song," Pickett said in a 1996 interview, "because some people never get to do anything."
That's really sweet. That's
Mike
really,
drop.
Yeah.
God love him. Say it with us, folks.
"I was working in the lab late one night."
I'm going hoarse with my enthusiasm for Bobby Boris Pickett. Jordan is staring into middle distance like a shell-shocked, hollow version of himself. This has been Too Much Information. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for more of our Spooktoberfest 2022. Right, Jordan? We got what, two more weeks of this?
Yeah, I believe so, yes.
I gotta keep the little SOBs occupied for a little while. Thanks for listening, folks. This has been Too Much Information. I'm Alex Heigl.
And I'm Jordan Runtalk. We'll catch you next time.
Too Much Information was a production of iHeartRadio.
The show's executive producers are Noel Brown and Jordan Runtalk.
The supervising producer is Mike Johns.
The show was researched, written, and hosted by Jordan Runtalk and Alex Heigl,
with original music by Seth Applebaum and the Ghost Funk Orchestra. If you like what you heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. For more podcasts on iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Nobody wants to outlive their money, but it happens, especially for women. That's why Gainbridge offers the Parity Flex annuity, designed for women's unique retirement needs, with flexible withdrawals plus a guaranteed lifetime income benefit that keeps paying you even if your account balance is zero. Gainbridge is helping build a better financial future for women. Retirement income you can't outlive is the ultimate flex. Start saving now at Gainbridge.io. Visit Gainbridge.io/ParityFlex for current rates, full product disclosures and disclaimers, and other important information.